This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another episode of Ohio Mystery Backroads. We're your hosts, Mike and Dan. And in this podcast, we will explore lesser-known stories, legends, people, and places of the Buckeye State. So buckle in, here we go. Hello. And welcome to part one of our episode of Hell's Half Acre. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ohio Mysteries Backroads. In this episode, we head down south to the sleepy little town of East Liverpool, Ohio. Nestled in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, this small river town has recently drawn worldwide attention due to the Norfolk Southern train derailment and chemical spill. However, tonight, we're not talking about train wrecks. Instead, we will be discussing murderers, fugitives, outlaws, and scoundrels, all in an area of East Liverpool known as Hell's Half Acre. Across from the table is Mike. Mike, hello. How are you?
Hello, Dan. I am good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, too. And boy, do I have a doozy of a story for us tonight.
That's great. So we're heading down to East Liverpool, and that's where Pretty Boy Floyd was killed, wasn't it? Does he have anything to do with this story?
Why, yes, he does, as a matter of fact, and it's really around that Depression-era time frame when he was killed that our story takes place.
That's really kind of the golden age of the American outlaw.
Yeah, it really was, and I think a lot of that had to do with the public perception that these outlaws were heroes who robbed banks to give money to the poor. Plus, I think the average Joe probably really didn't like Prohibition all that much and sort of admired the guy who took on the law, especially when booze was involved. And it's these factors that leads us into our story today. If you travel down Route 68 today, east out of the crumbling industrial wastelands of East Liverpool, Ohio, towards Pennsylvania, there's a small roadside marker, and it's called the Point of Beginning. It's an obelisk of sort, a tan marker. It's a small stone that's the reference point that the entire United States, except Texas, west of that exact point was surveyed against. You have to look quick, as it's easy to miss. There's a little place to park one or two cars if you want to stop and stretch your legs for a minute and take a picture. But before you leave, look across the road at the small plot of land just west of the marker. There's not much there. Some weeds, some rocks, some gravel. At this spot of land once stood one of the most dangerous and notorious bars in all of Ohio. The so-called bar was Ohio PA, or the State Line Bar, that served as the de facto center of an area that was to become known as Hell's Half Acre. From 1920 to the 1950s, this area gained notoriety for easy access to weapons, women, booze, and other assorted dangerous activities like gambling, prostitution, fighting, stabbing, shootings, and robberies.
So all this took place in that small pocket of a town.
Yes, and in fact, this was in the poor industrial part of town. Adding to the problem was the question of police jurisdiction. for Hell's Half Acre was located at the state line between Ohio and Pennsylvania, and at times, it was tough to find cops to even show up in the event of a problem. Compounding the problems was the fact that law enforcement was known to be paid to look the other way.
So corruption was alive and well.
Yes, and it seems like that's a common theme when it comes to these bootlegging prohibition era stories. This bar we're discussing, the Ohio PA Bar, was one that stood out above all others as the center of Hell's Half Acre activities. It was a small cinder block building that stood close to the road and very close to the border of Ohio, Pennsylvania. So if lawmen entered from one side, all of the patrons would quickly move to the opposite side of the bar to avoid arrest. If the police from Ohio were to raid the bar, the patrons would run to the Pennsylvania side of the bar. If police from Pennsylvania would show up, everyone would run to the Ohio side of the bar. Either way, the police couldn't touch them.
Yeah, actually, that sounds like fun.
It kind of does. After a few beers and, oh, shoot, here comes the law. Let's scoot to the other side. I believe the lawmen probably didn't think it was so funny, though. Not only did Hell's Half Acre provide goods and services to the local populace, but it was rumored to have served some infamous outlaws as well. Charles Pretty Boy Floyd was said to frequent the bar, using it as a hideout and a place to lay low. He was also rumored to have been en route to this bar when he was killed near Sprucevale in October 1934. Other outlaws, including John Dillinger and Babyface Nelson, were also said to frequent the Acre. Let's talk about one guy in particular, and this guy we're going to talk about is Willis Billy the Killer Miller, who was an active participant in the shenanigans of the Hell's Half Acre in the 1920s. His brother, Joseph Alabama Joe Miller, was also involved in bootlegging and became known as the King of State Line Bootleggers. We're going to talk about Joe a little bit later.
So the police know these outlaws were holed up there?
Yes, they did. And like I mentioned before, that part of the issue that seems to creep up in a lot of these outlaw places is the fact that these places exist on the border of different police jurisdictions. Police corruption, like I mentioned before, was also a problem, and the area became rampant with crime, and it got so bad that passing cars began to be stopped and robbed at gunpoint. So here, passing gangs are pulling over cars that are trying to travel down the road.
Wow.
Among the earliest recorded victims of this violence was a guy named Fred Wyand. He was 48, and he was from East Liverpool, and he was seriously injured in a dust-up at the Acre in October of 1923. He got drunk and got into a fight. Police arrested five men and who had been oversupplied with alcohol for this crime. It was claimed later that the group had been battling another group who mysteriously disappeared. Well, Mr. Wyland went home, but his condition worsened, and he was taken to City Hospital, where he died of a concussion to the brain. His father said that the state line crowd had served their own justice and attacked the offending men with blackjacks.
That sounds like a pretty tough place.
Yes, it surely does, and I think people were kind of tougher back then, and then it wasn't unusual to settle your problems with a fist fight. When you add alcohol to the equation, it's just a fight waiting to happen. An East Liverpool man remembered as a boy sneaking up to the State Line Bar late on Saturday nights to watch the action. There was usually a fight, and one time they saw two drunk men battling away outside. One drunk knocked the other out and down the front steps, then he rolled the unconscious loser over the hillside. The victor then proceeded to stagger back inside where the music was still blaring. The bar in the neighborhood were also known as Bucket of Blood around the area.
Did the police ever raid this place?
Yes, they did. In fact, on a hot day in June 1923, public outcry prompted the police to uproot lawless gangs at the infamous site. 21 Ohio and Pennsylvania police officers staged a raid which netted eight men on liquor charges. Small quantities of liquor were seized despite several futile attempts to destroy them. A newspaper report said many men and women were seeking relief from the heat when six carloads of lawmen stopped and headed for the drinking center. Three were taken to the town of Beaver for court action on charges of illegal possession of liquor. The others were cited and faced City Mayor Wilson for drunkenness. Police Chief Hugh McDermott was reported to have planned the raid, which also involved Columbiana and Beaver County Sheriff deputies. They did the raid, and fugitives running toward Pennsylvania were halted by the Ohio police. One guy tossed a pint of whiskey into the bushes, but it was recovered by an officer. Another culprit tried to kick a deputy who had grabbed his foot and was said to have thrown him.
Wouldn't these raids produce more results? I mean, I know you said, you know, like literally they would run to one side of the bar if it was Ohio, and then to the other side if it was PA, but apparently they'd still try to raid these places, right?
Well, and that's just it. You know, the criminals didn't have to abide by the law, but the cops did. So it made catching these guys really difficult. And I think a lot of this had to do with the fact that the bar sat on the state line. Plus, I think sometimes the cops were content on smashing the stills and bottles and destroying the alcohol and not really chasing the guys down.
So did these raids ever work then?
Well, seemingly not at first, as it was business as usual the next day. And I think some of these raids were merely perfunctory to satisfy an increasingly agitated number of upset East Liverpool citizens. There was obviously a steady supply of whiskey available in the area, and not of the best nor safest variety. Many patrons were sickened by contaminated liquor or that made from poisonous wood alcohol, while others simply drank too much. A Putnam Street man, Augustus Hoover, age 52, was found dead one Sunday morning in March 1926 on a hillside at the state line, claimed, according to the coroner, by alcoholism. By December 1923, the turmoil and the troubles at the notorious location would get so bad, a meeting was held in Columbus where federal and state agencies mapped out plans with local law officers to move against the illegal whiskey operations. The raid even included J.E. Russell, and he was a federal prohibition director for the state of Ohio, to help coordinate the raid. The raid was conducted by a combined force of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia law officers who raided the little wooded area in July 1924, where they arrested 17 men and 3 women. Newspaper called it the most successful crackdown to date, and it followed an attempt by federal agents to stem the liquor sales earlier. A special committee to combat the crime was organized after the death of an 18-year-old youth, Francis Wilson, who police said drank some poisonous whiskey. The day before the raid, police received a call that a man who had been beaten unconscious and another was being attacked by a gang there. The lawmen, Pennsylvania State Police, city officers, Columbiana County Sheriff Gomer Lewis and deputies, and Hancock Sheriff J.D. Mercer and his deputies began the raid just after 2 on a Saturday afternoon. The Pennsylvania men came from the east, the county deputies guarded the Liverpool Township line to the north, and Hancock began his raid to the south.
That sounds like a big raid, and as you said, they had no side to run to. They were all covered.
They have all their bases covered, correct. During the raid, one suspect, Joseph Miller, who we will discuss later, was slightly wounded by an officer when he attempted to draw his gun. Miller, officer said, was about to serve a drink to a Pennsylvania undercover officer when he observed the man's badge inside his coat. A cop knocked the gun from his hand and another fired, grazing Miller's neck. Miller was the same Joseph Miller found guilty by a Beaver County jury in 1914 of possessing, selling, and manufacturing whiskey in Hell's Half Acre. Miller, known as Alabama Joe, had been arrested at his home on the south side of the Ohio River near the state line after police of both states had failed to nab him. He was good at evading capture. In his defense, he said he was not Alabama Joe. It was a nickname applied to another person, a noted gambler whose last name was Watson, not Miller. soon Mayor Charles Brown would proudly declare the 1924 cleanup virtually complete, saying that there could be some small fry left, but the major bootleggers had been caught up in the net.
So Hell's Half Acre was cleaned up then?
Well, not really. While these raids did produce results, it certainly wasn't the scale that law enforcement had hoped. Plus, the bad guys and girls were back at it again the next day. Nevertheless, before the 18th Amendment was repealed in 1932, Hell's Half Acre was regarded as one of the nation's worst for bootlegging and outlaws.
You know what? They could have called an Elliot Ness.
You know, he probably would have done a good job. One report described the speakeasies as operating in conjunction with houses of prostitution, so it sounded like a full-service area. You could get anything you wanted. There was one person who presided over much of the Acre jurisdiction in the 20s and 30s, and this guy's name was Jacob Eckert. He was a World War I veteran who came to East Liverpool around 1920. Jake was born December 12, 1888, at Newcastle, Pennsylvania. He was the son of Jacob and Elizabeth Russell Eckert. He was 29 when America entered World War I as a mess sergeant with an infantry division. While Eckert was a small man, he was known as a ferocious fighter, and he had a set of brass knuckles that sometimes helped his technique. According to one tale, Jake was behind the bar and ordered two or three disorderly toughs to leave. They laughed at him and made comments about what they were going to do to Jake in his place. Jake vaulted over the bar, the brass knuckles already on, and downed one man with a blow to the head. The others crowded in on him, but he smashed their faces and put them away. Jake dragged them all through the front door and tossed them out onto the ground. Now, the Eckert home was a one-story frame building with an attic and a brick basement at the Pennsylvania line. And the house is gone. The house was knocked down, but the house was up on the hillside, and the bar was down on along the road. And they said that there was a tunnel that ran between the two places. And it was known that this guy had a hose that went from a still in the Eckert house all the way down, probably 300 feet, down to this bar. So really, they had running liquor full time, all the time.
Wow.
And yes, and so there were some houses, kind of just shacks, around the Eckert house. And the Eckerts would let people sleep off the booze. In fact, they hid a lot of people in those houses, and because it wasn't a place where people could get liquor, the law couldn't touch them. The law couldn't raid these houses, and it was closely guarded. And they would guard it with dogs and guns. It was crazy. So they really had a little compound they were building, including this state line bar. It was a one-story frame building, and it had an attic and a brick basement, and it was on the Pennsylvania line. A commonly held belief about the main house was that it was either exactly on the state line or that the boundary ran through part of the structure, but in reality, it was actually west of the bar. And like I mentioned, a hose was said to have run from a still at the Eckert house all the way down to the bar. Now, a leading figure in the neighborhood was Jake's wife, Jenny, who had resided at the Acre for many years and was well known throughout the region as State Line Jenny. And I love that nickname, and it sounds like somebody I should know. Can you imagine telling your wife, "Hey, honey, don't wait up. I'm going to go see State Line Jenny."
She sounds nice.
She does sound nice. So Jenny was born on July 17, 1889 in Washington County, Ohio, and she was the daughter of John Shreves and Margaret Christopher Shreves. Her and Jake got married and came to East Liverpool in 1913. Now, Jake would die at 52 from pneumonia on July 20th, 1941, and his obituary reported that he was last employed with the Chenango Valley Steel Company at Newcastle. The burial was held in Newcastle, and Mrs. Eckert would secure a liquor license in later years and sold beer to the residents of nearby homes. But she didn't really care. She would sell beer to anybody. And an area resident said that the bar formally opened once a year to meet a legal requirement for retaining the license. The rest of the year, it wasn't officially open, but you could get in if you had a couple nickels to rub together and you were thirsty. As well, youngsters as young as 10 and 11 often walked to the Eckert place to buy firecrackers from Jenny. It was said that even if you had just a penny, she would always have something for you. Age didn't matter. So she would sell anything to anybody. It didn't matter your age. It didn't matter who you were. If you had money, you could buy anything you wanted.
Wow.
Jenny would later become a minister of the First Spiritualist Church. And among the church crowd, she was known as the Reverend Jenny Eckert. Among the Hellsaf Acre crowd, she was known as Stateline Jenny.
So she had two titles going on here.
She probably had more than two titles going on.
All right.
She was a tall, slender woman, and she was a familiar figure in the East End and downtown areas of East Liverpool. She often wore long dresses and a broad-brimmed hat. She wore many rings on her fingers and often spoke in a clear, steady voice. Jenny also would give spiritual readings in her home. It wasn't unusual to see Cadillacs and other luxurious automobiles with license plates from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Ohio parked at her house, while their owners had their palms read and fortunes told. It wasn't unusual for her to charge clients as much as $3.50 for these readings, which I'm sure was a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
A nurse with whom Jenny had contact with said she offered tips on horse racing and other matters, which Jenny said she received from these spiritual readings. At this point, Jenny went into partnership with the Spiritualist Church.
So it was safe to say she wasn't boring doing all these different things.
You know, she kind of sounded like a lot of fun, honestly. Stateline Jenny, I'd go hang out and drink at her place.
You know, it was during this time, I think, that Houdini was going around the country exposing spiritualists. I wonder if he ever heard of her or if she was really that well known that he would have heard of her. But yeah, this was around that time. He was going around exposing all these spiritualists.
Oh, that's right. Boy, it'd be fascinating to know if he ever went through East Liverpool, Ohio. I'm going to dig into that. I'm going to find out. That might be a fun follow-up to this.
Okay.
Well, a city physician remembers being called at around 3 a.m. one night in the 1950s to the Eckert house when Jenny became ill. At that time, he said, a cyclone-type fence with a barbed wire on top was circling the building and it contained her dogs. And he was let through a gate. And I think that these dogs were prized. She had, I think, like eight dogs that guarded her property. I think they were Doberman Pinschers, if I recall the story correctly. So this physician gave Jenny the medication to ease what he believed was gallbladder pain. When Jenny asked the doctor what the fee for the visit was, he replied, that'll be $10. Jenny then told one of the men in the room to give the doctor $20. The guy opened a drawer filled with stacks of money and peeled off a $20 bill for the doctor. Jenny, who liked to talk and was often considerate in providing a little house very cheaply until the renters got on their feet. Jenny would also provide beer to many people on credit, permitting those short of cash to wet their whistle and build up large tabs. It was said that Jenny cleaned up conditions around Hell's Half Acre after Jake's death in 1941, but she continued the beer sales, both from the basement of her home as well as the Stateline Bar. That was part one of our episode on Hell's Half Acre. Stay tuned for part two. Hello, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and want to hear more like it, head over to OhioMysteries.com. With over 500 podcasts to choose from, there's sure to be one that's going to keep you captivated. I'm Dan, and I can be found at YouTube at North Coast History and Haunts. My partner Mike can be found at Facebook at Too Late for Autographs.
The Korean War has sadly been known as the Forgotten War, but half a century earlier, the United States was locked in a bloody conflict in Asia that's been all but erased from the history books. Hi, I'm Alex Hasty, the host of Ohio vs. the World, an American history podcast on the Evergreen Podcast Network. In our newest episode, we speak to experts about the Philippine-American War, America's first Asian counterinsurgency conflict. The heroes, the villains. We'll discuss President McKinley, Admiral Dewey, the vicious brutality of the fighting, and the scandals and war crimes that nearly sunk Theodore Roosevelt's presidency. Check out our show, Ohio vs. the World, on the Evergreen Podcast Network, for our new episode about America's most forgotten war. Now back to the show.